Welcome to episode 318 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
This is one in our continuing series on robotics and automation. If you'd like to hear the other episodes, you can find them by visiting thelabwithbrad.com.
How are you?
Oh, first off, no show next week.
Thank God.
It's Phil's birthday.
Oh.
So that's our holiday.
Yay.
Next, I've dialed in the knobs differently, and we're getting some distortion the last couple of episodes. I didn't like it. I hope this is better. Now I have much to say about nothing.
Let's do it.
Vacuum.
Okay. Oh, right. Nothing.
See? Isn't that clever? Mm-hmm. All right. So you actually get vacuum before you get the vacuum pump.
Really?
Okay. Yes. And when I say vacuum, I don't mean there's nothing there at all, because that's really hard to do. Just a lot less than usual.
Okay.
And often, to be interesting and useful, surrounded by a bunch of stuff that is there.
Okay.
Yeah, the suction pump, for example. And I like the piston pump. It's easiest for me to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
You got a cylinder, right? And it's hollow. It's like a tube. And then you've got a piston.
Heck yeah.
Which is a roundy thingy that fits inside of it.
All right.
Yeah, and then slides along the inside.
Okay.
And it's pretty easy to use this thing at the top of some other tube that goes down into the water.
Okay, yeah.
You lift the piston up, the intake valve is open, some water flows into the little chamber, and then the intake valve closes and an outtake valve opens, and the piston comes back down and the water gets pushed back out to where you want it.
Heck yeah.
Instead of down in the mine.
We're working here. Okay.
Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that vacuum had energy.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
He'd come up with the idea that, yes, the piston moves, and that causes a nothingness to occur.
Right.
And then he thought that was doing all the work.
Okay.
He believed in suction.
Suction is power. Okay.
But that theory doesn't explain why you can't pump water with a suction pump more than about 34 feet upwards.
Okay.
So it took a while, and another guy comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Italian guy.
No, let's do this.
Evangelisto Corselli.
Corselli, sure.
Which I'm certainly butchering, but there you go.
Sounds good to me.
1643, he came up with the notion that maybe it's the pressure of the air pushing the water up the tube.
Oh, okay.
And thought, well, if water is heavier than air, which it is, noticeably, then the column of water, once it weighs more than the column of air that's over you, wouldn't get pushed up anymore.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
So then he tried it with mercury, which is much heavier than water even.
Yeah, yeah.
He took a glass tube, sealed on one end, filled it with mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Put the other end, the open end, in a bath of mercury.
Okay.
And tilted it up straight.
Okay.
Right. So the mercury kind of falls down the tube a little bit.
Oh, okay.
This was a barometer, actually. And there's a vacuum at the top because the mercury drops down. The air pressure can't push it up any further.
Okay. Okay.
So that's our first vacuum. In 1650...
Okay.
A guy had heard about, hey, there's this thing called vacuum, and he thought, maybe I could make a pump that would make vacuum.
Okay, so why not?
Ye old cylinder and piston pump with a couple of valves, fitting tighter than most of your water pumps, because it has to in order to do what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Otto von Guericke.
Ooh.
Ooh. I know. What a great name.
Yeah.
In 1650, he took his Magdeburg spears. He was the mayor of Magdeburg, which was recently recovering from a horrible sweep, burn the city, kill everyone there, 30 years war thing.
Ooh, goodness. They need a product.
Yeah, they do. He took two copper bowls.
Okay.
Hemispherical bowls. They're about 20 inches across, about 50 centimeters.
Okay.
Then he put grease on the rims and fit them together.
Okay.
And one of them is a little hole that is closed off by a valve.
Okay.
Or open, depending upon how you put the valve. So the valve's open, you put a tube on that. The other end of the tube is his trusty vacuum pump.
Okay.
Yeah. You ran that for a little while. Mm-hmm. And then you close the valve and pull off the tube. And I suppose at some point you're going to want to turn off the pump.
Okay.
Now he's got a vacuum, at least a partial vacuum, inside the spheres. Uh-huh. We don't know how good his pump was, but given the size of what he was playing with, he could easily get 4,000 pounds of air pressure holding these two things together.
Nice.
And he used to do public demonstrations where, for example, 30 horses and two teams of 15 couldn't pull them apart.
Nice.
So some people were thinking, hey, is there some way we could get vacuum to do something for us?
Right? It seems promising.
So this French guy, whose name I didn't even write down.
He's French.
The guy who invented the pressure cooker. He wrote a treatise on how you might be able to mechanically use vacuum. His trick was to notice that water, when it becomes water vapor or steam, takes up much more space.
Oh.
So what if we do it the other direction? We could fill a cylinder with steam and then rapidly cool it.
Mm-hmm.
So it would, the steam would go back to being water and suddenly take up less space.
I see that.
And make a vacuum.
Yep.
And then the air pressure would push the cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And then the band would play, the horns would sound, the girls would dance.
Heck yeah.
I put that poorly. I could put that better. Imagine a cylinder with a piston at the far end. So there's as much space between the piston and the other end of the cylinder as possible. You fill that up with steam. And then you cool it down rapidly by spraying water on the outside, or in some designs, even on the inside of it, which turns the steam back into water, leaving a partial vacuum, or a low-pressure, zone. And then the air pressure will push on the piston and push it inside the cylinder, and that's your power stroke. That's what I meant to say, and now we can move on with our lives. So in 1698, Thomas Savery built one.
Okay.
To pump water out of mines.
Seeing a trend here. Okay.
It took a while to make this into a really practical device, but it went on to do all sorts of wonderful things. Getting boats across oceans and trains across land masses, carrying freight and passengers.
Holy crap.
The steam engine.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they call this thing.
Oh, I wasn't tracking until you said steam engine. That thing!
I did kind of bury the lead. Meanwhile, some people were still playing with vacuum pumps and electricity.
Okay.
Because you could take some air out of a tube and put a couple of things inside the tube and then hook those up to wires and then hook up those to the either end of your battery terminal.
Yes.
And then things would happen.
Sounds illuminating.
Right. So at first, they took a little air out, and then they'd fire it up, and it would glow, and it was pretty.
Yeah, okay.
And then they found over time that the more air they took out, the more a dark gap would show up around one of the electrodes.
Weird.
The
okay.
Cathode, if you care which one.
If somebody does.
And the more air you took out, the further that dark spot would go.
Okay.
And once that dark spot got all the way to the far end of the tube, the other end of the tube would start to glow.
Okay.
Because electrons are getting accelerated from the cathode to the anode, and they're going so fast by the time they get there, some of them go right past the darn thing.
Okay.
And then they bombard the glass, which causes it to glow some.
Okay.
Which is a neat trick, and we'll talk more about that later.
Okay. Oh.
But while they were playing with it, occasionally they'd notice that also something across the lab would start to glow.
Wait a minute. It wasn't a human, was it?
A lot of researchers noticed and didn't do much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But our boy, again German,
okay,
in 1895, Wilhelm Röntgen.
Wow.
Wilhelm, maybe? He's a German physics professor.
Okay.
Nobody's certain what Wilhelm was working on when he noticed.
Okay.
A lot of people had noticed off and on.
Mm-hmm.
But he did have screens that would fluoresce when hit by X-rays, which he named because he didn't know what they were.
The X stands for I'll name it later.
Yeah, kind of.
I love it.
And he noticed you could put things in front of it, and they'd still go through and make the little dot on the screen. So he was experimenting this, and the story goes that he put a chunk of lead there
okay.
and noticed in this flickering phosphorescent phosphorescent image, whereas a shadowy picture of his skeleton.
Wow.
Which he told no one about. Okay. It was a pretty subtle effect. He wasn't sure if he was seeing what he thought he was seeing. Mm-hmm. So he first figured out how to make a picture of it.
Okay.
And did the first x-ray of a human hand, or, yeah, the first deliberate image of bones with his wife's hand. And she said something like, "I've seen my death."
Oh, no.
Yeah. But anyway, x-rays have nothing to do with robots.
Okay. Oh, right.
Right. Just like everything we talked about on Monday. Ah, it's Monday.
Hmm. Good segue.
Yeah, thanks. In keeping with the spirit of Monday, meaning the thing that we never do.
Yeah.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with the rest of the episode.
All right.
I'm excited. I mean, I could stretch it and make it kind of fit.
Uh-huh.
But it's just something I ran into when I was looking up siphons.
Okay. Water. We talked about water.
We did talk about water and siphons last episode, 317, which you can find by visiting thelabwithbrad.com. I bumped into a thing called the chain fountain.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also called Newton's beads.
Okay.
You've got a jar of chain.
Right, right.
It's all coiled up inside of there.
Mm-hmm.
And you pull one end out over the lip until the end dangling down weighs more than the end being pulled up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It doesn't have to be the more than the whole chain because the rest of the chain is being held up by the jar and the table or whatever.
Yes, yes.
All right. So it starts sliding down like you'd expect.
Yeah, absolutely.
The weird bit happens when that little, the place where it's rubbing across the rim.
Right.
Seemingly levitates.
Right? Yeah.
Above the edge of the jar.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like fluid going through a siphon.
Oh, yeah.
Except it's not a fluid. And there is no tube. What's happening?
Some magic weight. Just, I don't know. Is it like water?
Well, fun questions. It's... And also, you just, I don't know either. There are theories.
Oh, of course they don't actually. Okay.
There are theories. One of them is that it's a kind of a leverage thing.
Okay.
If you look at the way the individual links are behaving.
Right.
When it's getting pulled up. It would like to rotate around its center of gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can't. So it ends up pushing down on the jar, and apparently somehow that works out to a little upward momentum somehow.
Right. That makes... Okay.
Yeah.
Clear as mud.
I was playing with my fidget spinner. And yeah, you get a good spin on it, and you touch it against the surface, you get a force. It bounces, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's kind of like that. But I'm not really sure. Also, I would think if rotation matters, the top of the arc, those links are getting rotated.
Right.
And the other links next to them are resisting that motion.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be some sort of doohickey going on there.
Ah, the doohickey. The
doohickey. Chains are funny anyway. Like when they're hanging.
Right.
And still. They don't quite form a parabola like you would think they would. They form something called a concatenary.
Gigabahama?
Which is the graph of the hyperbolic tangent, if you really want to know.
Oh, thank God you told me that. Now I can pretend to do the math.
And that is theoretically because there's a sideways push from the links hanging off of each other, almost as if it was a continuous bit of rope.
Oh.
But those dynamics don't work to explain what's going on with this thing.
No.
Supposedly looking at the individual links does explain it. And if that's... so they did an experiment. They used a rope or string between beads, theorizing that that wouldn't give you much lever action, and so the effect should be reduced or eliminated. And lo and behold, it was eliminated.
Oh.
So maybe they're onto something here.
Yeah, that's at least there's one experiment that supports their claim.
There's another one, right, where if it's getting an upward push while it's being rotated and pulled out of the jar, then if it's hitting some other surface, it should get another kick to it while it's being forced to rotate by hitting the other surface. Right?
Right.
Maybe. See, I'm explaining something I don't get. I promised I wouldn't do this. I promised myself I wouldn't cry. But in 2011, Cornell University, some mechanical engineers did some experiments where they had one chain fall down and land on a table.
Okay.
And another chain fall down through free space.
Okay.
gravity, right?
Yeah.
The chain is experiencing acceleration. You expect the one that doesn't hit anything to end up going faster.
Right.
But the one that hits the table first ends up going faster.
I don't understand. Yeah.
Let's see, to quote Chris Griffin from the animated series Family Guy, I don't know! So let's get back to something that actually has something to do with robots.
We're on the way.
Or at least sort of. Okay. Remember, even before we got to that x-ray thing, uh-huh. they could get the glass sort of glowing on the other side of one of these tubes.
Yes, yes.
Right. Vacuum tube, that's one name for them. Or okay. discharge tube is another.
Ooh, I like vacuum tube better.
Yes. So they painted the end of it mm-hmm. with some sort of fluorescent chemical
okay.
to make the dot even brighter.
Yeah.
And then they notice they can move the dots with magnets.
Wow. Okay.
Yes, which eventually leads to things like a cathode ray tube.
Hey.
You know, computer monitors, televisions.
Yeah.
Little things like that. They came in handy.
Heck yeah.
In 1907.
Okay.
This guy named Lee DeForest was playing around with one of these tubes.
Okay.
And he found that you could put a grid between the cathode and anode. Uh-huh. And then you could put a charge on that if it was negative.
Mm-hmm.
It would drastically decrease the amount of current going through the tube.
Okay.
If it was positive, it could drastically increase the amount of current okay. going through the tube.
Yeah, yeah.
This gave us amplification.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Finally.
Okay.
It also turned out that you could coax these triodes, as they were eventually called,
mm-hmm.
into doing logic
oh.
and binary arithmetic.
Ah.
All they really needed was some kind of RAM.
Well, heck yeah.
Which they did by a specially modified cathode ray tube.
they love these things.
Called a Wilson tube.
Hmm.
And then we get our first digital computers.
Nice.
Which have a heck of a lot to do with robots and automation.
We made it.
Yes.
There was a reason for all of this.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that
ah.
next time. See you then.
Bye.